ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a quantum computer has been just around the corner. So, where is it?
If you'd asked me very early on, I would have been very pessimistic.
The race to build a quantum computer...
Then I got more pessimistic.
Can anyone actually do it?
And more pessimistic.
One of the biggest tech stories on Earth. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. If you've ever been through a divorce, you can know it can feel like a breaking, a fracture that reverberates throughout a family. But today, you'll hear from someone who wants to reframe it as a renovation, not a demolition. Her book is called The Good Divorce. She says that's not an oxymoron, it's possible. More on that in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, you make hundreds of decisions a day that affect your life because deep down, you believe you have the ability to control what happens. But if you accept that free will doesn't exist, are you making different choices? New research says maybe yes. I'll get into it with our resident philosopher soon here on ABC Radio National. But first, if you went to high school anytime before the 2010s, you probably had to endure some truly mortifying lessons on the miracle of life. In my day, sex ed was something the teachers sprung on us during school camp. They wheeled in a television set and whacked on an outdated, terrifying video about STIs, which is very different to the way most kids learn about sex and relationship these days. But research suggests we're not exactly killing it yet. A recent survey of Australian school teachers found more than half had no formal training in sex and relationships education before becoming a teacher. Many of them feel poorly equipped for the job. And at the same time, teenagers are navigating increasingly complex relationships and crying out for support. If they can't find the answers they need online, and the teachers educating them in the classroom aren't confident to guide them, where do they turn? Well, you're about to hear from two people with ideas about this, but I would love to hear your reminiscences this morning. What kind of sex ed did you get at school? And how does it compare to what your kids got if you've got them? Tell me about what sex ed looked like for you back in the day. And with me is Dr. Lily Moore from the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society at La Trobe University. She's the co-author of this survey asking Australian school teachers about their experiences teaching sex and relationships education. Lily, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've been talking to hundreds of teachers around Australia. Do any of them really want to be the ones lecturing a hall full of snickering teenagers about sex?
It is sort of a mammoth task. What we found in the survey was about two-thirds of teachers reported that they actually really enjoyed delivering RSE, and the broad majority believed that it was really important for schools to be delivering this content to students, but there was really varying degrees of comfort and confidence in their delivery depending on the topic. And teachers were most commonly assigned to teaching RSE because of their subject area, so most commonly health and PE teachers, rather than, you know, a real sort of passion for the subject.
Right, like you're the biology teacher, you know about this stuff, go and talk to the kids about sex.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what kind of stood out to you from this survey?
I think what you mentioned about teachers not receiving, you know, substantial training or time to prepare their lessons. They're not getting sufficient pre-service training. So it was about 60% that had received no training on how to deliver RSE, the content that they would be delivering in their university teaching degrees. And that continued in service. So about 40% of teachers indicated that they still felt like they required additional training.
So you looked at gender of teachers as well. How did that play into how comfortable they felt talking about sex and relationships?
It didn't necessarily play a role in their confidence in specific topics, but the sort of main significant difference between male teachers and female teachers was that male teachers were much more concerned about risks to their professional reputation when teaching RSE. And this came up in the interviews with teachers as well. Male teachers were really sort of cautious and feeling nervous about teaching sensitive topics to female students and really worrying about misinterpretation of what they were sort of delivering or how their actions could be misinterpreted. And female teachers felt the same way in sort of a different gender-related way.
They were talking to boys.
Yeah, they were really aware of, you know, sexist comments, delivering sort of sensitive topics that invoked sort of misogynistic attitudes from students and how to navigate that.
Well, also here with us is Evan Cooper from Consent Labs, which is a not-for-profit organisation that does workshops and provides resources for young people around respectful relationships. Evan, listening to Lily describe the findings of this survey, does that align with what you hear in your work?
Hi, Tegan. Yeah, absolutely. This really does mirror exactly what we are seeing on the ground when we are working with educators. So we know that many of them are allocated consent and sex education on top of their already really full workloads, regardless of their own expertise or their comfort with the subject matter themselves, which is why specialist providers like us exist. Consent Labs works to fill that gap by providing that really evidence-based program so that we can make sure there's consistency in the delivery of consent education across Australia.
So, Evan, are you delivering education to teachers on how to teach this, or are you delivering it to students directly, or both?
We work with schools to implement a whole-of-school approach. So we work directly with students in both secondary and tertiary settings. But we're also working with parents, carers and teachers to ensure we're actually building their internal capability to be able to provide that really whole-of-school holistic approach to make sure that it's the responsibility of that whole community so that we're seeing behaviour and positive communication, respectful communication modelled by everyone.
You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Dr. Lily Moore, a researcher from La Trobe University. She's the co-author of a recent study asking Australian teachers about their experiences teaching sex education. And I'm also with Evan Cooper, who's the acting head of curriculum for Consent Labs, which is a not-for-profit that provides this sort of education in Australian schools. And I'm asking you what sex ed looked like for you and how that compared to what your kids got. Honestly, some of the stories you're telling me are horrifying, and I can just imagine how horrified you're going to be, Evan and Lily. One says, my mother was born in 1923. As her wedding to my father approached, her sex education was non-existent. She asked her mother what she should do on the wedding night. Her mother's response was, just watch out when Jimmy gets up to his tricks. Being none the wiser as to what Jimmy's tricks were, she asked her future mother-in-law. My dad's mum burst into tears and ran out of the room. This person says she must have figured it out as she went on to have my brother and me. Well, there you go. Another says my sex ed consisted of being told that to kiss a boy before you got married was a mortal sin. Evan, I feel like we're maybe doing things a bit better than we used to.
I'd like to think so. I think we've come a long way. I think there's still, where, you know, definitely strides that we could be taking. But in terms of our ability to deliver really strong, evidence-informed consent education that we know resonates with students and that is relevant to their lived experience, we're definitely seeing a huge improvement from what has been practiced in the past, for sure.
So just a couple more texts. We're getting a couple of people asking what RSE stands for. It's Relationships and Sex Education. Is that right, Lily?
Yeah, Relationships and Sexuality Education.
And so Philip says here, it'd be better if sex education at school was unnecessary. Students knowing what they wanted to know from their unembarrassed parents. Lily, is that a future that we might ever see?
Oh, it's a tough question. Look, we know that adults are really uncomfortable talking to each other about sex. It does sort of feel like, you know, we are asking a lot of teachers here, and I think that's what we're trying to do with the findings from this report, is really demonstrate that this is why they need better support. You know, they're not expected to have all of the answers. They're just expected to create a safe, informed learning environment and have the capacity and feel confident to have conversations about complex topics. And they're just not getting the training, time or support to be able to do that.
Evan, when you're doing these workshops with students, what kind of engagement are you getting from them? Because if someone asked me to talk to a group of 15-year-olds about sex, I like to think of myself as being pretty cool, but that is terrifying. And I think I'm scared of children. Are you scared of children?
I think if I was, I wouldn't be in the right role, Tegan. So I appreciate, though, that it is a very daunting prospect to have conversations like, you know, on topics such as pornography, such as sexting with a classroom of 14-year-olds is probably not something anyone would find too super easy. But luckily, our specialist providers like us, we do have really well-trained young facilitators who are able to build rapport and credibility with a student with students in a way that I think directly resonates more with their lived experience. So we actually are able to bring those insights that means that education and those conversations are a lot easier to have.
Why do you think the age of the facilitators is important?
I think it's around the fact that for many of our facilitators, they not so long ago themselves were in high school and were navigating the realities and the scenarios that teenagers find themselves having to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So being able to draw directly from that experience in a really contemporary way that acknowledges the changes that have taken place since many of their parents and teachers might have been teenagers themselves.
Lily, is that realistic for Australian schools? Like, sometimes it's just like whoever's in the room on the day is the one that's delivering this education.
Yeah, that can definitely be the case. And I think what Evan was saying about, you know, trying to build this whole of school approach through the collaboration between teachers and schools and external specialist educators, that's what we found to be most effective. That's when teachers felt the most supported. They felt comfortable and confident to deliver content. And it was sort of embedded in this planned and sustained approach to sex ed across the school rather than just reacting to an issue that's happened in the school recently or a problem amongst students. It's sort of an ongoing continuum of student care and well-being.
Yeah, in your research, you looked at sort of basically the role of external providers like Evan versus the teachers of the school being the ones to provide this education.
Yeah, we did. And most teachers agreed that they preferred a school-led delivery model with support from external educators, much more than just external educators or just the teachers. They really appreciated that collaboration. And that was really important for really sensitive or complex topics. Like Evan was saying, having somebody with specific knowledge on something like sexting or porn was really beneficial to teachers who just don't have the time to, you know, really get into how to talk about this with young people.
Evan, how do you talk about those sorts of things with young people?
It's a great question. I think a lot of our approach to especially those more sensitive topics are really by building basic media literacy skills. So being able to equip students with the skills to understand the content that they're actually consuming, to be able to be critical about the messages that they're being exposed to and make really informed choices that are very values aligned in terms of what they want to be taking on from that.
It's kind of weird to be thinking of media literacy as relevant to sex education, but here we are. You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Dr. Lily Moore from La Trobe University and Evan Cooper from Consent Labs. We're talking about sex education, baby. I want to know what it was like for you back in the day, how it compares to what you're seeing with your own kids these days. One says back last century, sometime in the early 80s, we were shown a video of a woman actually giving birth. I was horrified. Another says, Kim says, when I looked for a school for my daughters, the kind of sex ed the school offered was part of the decision. We went with the school where students would know how to get a condom on any garden vegetable, not the Catholic version where contraception was not allowed to be taught. Kim adds, the co-education school we chose actually used actual replicas to deal with condom education. And another, in 1976, I started in grade 10, co-ed private school. Sex ed class covered all the ways people fit together and how to get pregnant, how to not get pregnant, STDs, how not to get them, even a film of a birth, even touched on homosexuality. It was brilliant. I so didn't want to have those conversations with my perfectly approachable mother. Evan, what is the benefit of a stranger telling you about this super private stuff?
I think the benefit that having an external come in or someone who is not so intimately known to you is that there is a bit of safety in being able to have perhaps more in-depth conversations or even ask curious questions that you might not otherwise feel super comfortable asking someone who you're then going to continue to have that regular contact with. So I think that definitely allows for a more curious learning environment, that having that external presence in someone who's actually able to go, you can ask me anything. I've heard everything that there possibly is to ask about this. I promise you nothing you can say will shock or surprise me, and I will give you an honest answer. There is a real level of safety in that.
So a lot of this conversation is about the sex part of sex and relationships education, but relationships is part of it. Lily, we had mandatory consent education introduced into the Australian curriculum in 2023. How is that trickling down into the content that teachers are working from?
Yeah, I mean, from the study, we found that around only one third of teachers said that their schools had discussed these recent policy changes with them, and about the same had received training or support to implement it. So it was about two thirds that hadn't been spoken to about their school, by their school, about the changes to consent policy, and hadn't received training to support it. So we're seeing sort of a bit of a widening gap between the expectation of this policy and what's actually happening in classrooms. And so the part of consent education is not just necessarily teaching young people about what consent is or isn't, which is a really complex conversation in and of itself. But also we had teachers, you know, the majority of teachers telling us that they hadn't received any training on how to respond to student disclosures of sexual violence, which is a really important finding. You know, if we're talking about consent, we're opening up these conversations for young people. We want to know that they can feel comfortable and safe speaking to their teacher about it, and their teacher knows how to respond in those situations.
Absolutely. As soon as you start a conversation, you've got to be prepared for where it might go. Another sort of topic in this space, Lily, is pleasure. How do teachers feel about teaching students about that?
That was right down the bottom for the list of topics that they were most comfortable with, and right up the top for the ones they were most uncomfortable with. So it was quite a sticking point for teachers. It seemed like that was really a tricky topic to tackle.
So, Evan, you're developing resources for teachers alongside the work that you deliver. Do you have any sort of top-line advice for anyone who's listening being like, oh, my gosh, how do I talk about this?
Totally, yeah. I mean, with the support of our educators, we've been in the process of making, like, resources that do actually directly translate to their experience of the in-classroom conversations. And a lot of those come down to the really interpersonal soft skills of how do I ensure that I'm establishing a safe and supportive learning environment so that if a student comes to me with a question, I can actually say, hey, I don't know the answer to that. I'm going to come with you to find that out together. I think that can be in itself a really powerful thing, to be alongside a student in their inquiry, in their curiosity, and approaching those maybe gnarlier or scarier topics with just a lot of compassion and empathy and willingness to learn and understand what's actually happening in that young person's lives.
We've got a text here from Lee who says, I've been a teacher in a state high school for over 25 years. I'm female. I found the best way to talk about sex and protection, and I found the best way is to just go for it. Speak openly and honestly without timidity. The kids can be a bit shocked for a few minutes, but it doesn't last long and away we go. My advice to younger teachers is not to be fearful. Lily, Evan, how do you react to that?
I mean, yeah, it's incredible advice. And I think that that's exactly what we need to be supporting teachers to do, to sort of, you know, reduce that fear, feel confident, feel capable, know who to turn to when they're not quite sure, and to, yeah, collaborate with external specialist educators like Evan.
Absolutely. I would also say that to that point, if we want to make sure that teachers are feeling really confident and are feeling really able to have those tricky conversations, they actually really need to be supported by that long-term funding for teacher upskilling and professional development. So we need to see them being supported to be able to actually achieve the desired outcomes from this mandate.
Evan, are these sorts of conversations that you just have once with kids, or is this an ongoing conversation?
Not at all. I think having a once-off conversation is maybe some people's experience, but we know the evidence shows that the best way to ensure students are getting really comprehensive and engaging and lifelong consent education is that it is a lifelong conversation that is really tailored to the different stages and the different developmental lessons that will be relevant for that student at each point in their life. So we need to get into the practice of being able to have those open conversations to make sure that person feels comfortable to come to us with questions at any point.
Well, Evan, Lily, thank you both so much for chatting with me. Evan Cooper, Acting Head of Curriculum for Consent Labs, a not-for-profit providing respectful relationships education in schools. And Dr. Lily Moore, Research Officer at the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society at La Trobe University, co-author of this new national study of Australian teachers. And thank you for the trip down memory lane about what sort of sex ed you got back in the day. A sex ed teacher was a nun. All us 14-year-olds knew much more than she did. We felt very sorry for the dear lady's embarrassment. Another says, our early 70s public school sex ed was disturbing. A very old-seeming woman, she was probably 35, was brought in and we were split by gender. That part was okay. But she cryptically delivered that we might one day find a white dot in our period blood. She refused to say what this would be, acting like it was something fearful and shameful. To this day, in my mid-60s, I still haven't figured it out. And my grandma described to my mum when she was young that women get pregnant by boys' private parts touching girls' private parts. Mum thought that meant her breasts. Well, we have come a long way, but as Lily and Evan says, we've still got a bit more of a way to go. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, is it possible to have a good divorce? What would that even look like? Some tips from someone who coaches people through a happier end to their marriage.
The Science Show is always full of surprises.
I just find it too hard to euthanize insects.
What about a mosquito in your bedroom at nighttime?
There are always exceptions.
What makes sex chromosomes so troublesome?
Sex chromosomes are very, very weird.
How human are you in terms of your genome?
At least 8% of us is not human in origin.
The Science Show, Saturdays at midday on ABC Radio National and anytime on ABC Listen.
In 2025, divorces increased by 4% across Australia. That's according to new data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And while you don't get married expecting to divorce, the reality is it does happen. When you walk away from the person you thought you'd be with forever, it can be pretty traumatic, no matter how mature you both are. And one in two divorces involves kids, so things are bound to get messy at some point. Is there a way to do it that isn't so damaging? Is it possible to have a good divorce? And what does that actually look like in practice? Maintaining a healthy but different relationship with your ex, your kids, your shared social circle? Well, you're about to meet someone who wants to change the way we think about divorce, not as the destruction of a family, but as a renovation. And if you've been through a divorce and come out the other side, I'd love to hear from you. If you think you're a co-parenting success story, if you think you've nailed a good divorce, how did you do it? Here with me is Karen McNenny, author of The Good Divorce, How to End Your Marriage Without Ending Your Family. Karen, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks, Tegan, for sharing the platform, the microphone, and hello to all of your listeners down under.
When you say to people that it's possible to have a good divorce, what kind of reaction do you tend to get from them?
First, I get eye rolls, and then I get head shakes, impossible. And then I get looks of hope. Tell me more.
Okay. So this is something that you have lived. And then since then, you've also guided a lot of families through it. Do you mind sharing a bit of your own story?
15 years ago, it was clear that our marriage as we knew it and our family was going to dissolve for 5,000 reasons and five, right? There's never one thread in the tapestry of marriage. And honestly, I thought to myself, I cannot be an enemy with the father of my children for the rest of my life, because that's what happens as soon as you entangle your DNA and you share children. And as I tell people, your marriage might be ending, not your relationship. That's forever. And there was no other answer. Everyone just said, call an attorney, lawyer up, go into battle. And I just thought there must be a different way. And we found a way on our own, sort of hunting and pecking around, until eventually, about 5 years ago, I then became a certified divorce coach, a mediator, a co-parent specialist, a parent team expert, really leaning into this topic to try and help more families, not just get divorced. Attorneys will help us do that. But actually how to be divorced. What's the long shadow of divorce that stays with the family long after the ink has dried on the paper?
So you and your husband we're obviously talking about this together, like going, our marriage is ending. So obviously what held you together before is fractured somehow. How did you manage to even have those conversations in a way that was constructive?
Interestingly enough, we were in couples therapy, fighting for the marriage, as many of us are, when it became apparent we were going to dissolve our marriage. So we were already on the same side of the table. And I remember when we started that particular journey of couples therapy, because it was not the first time, and our therapist asking us, why are we here and when will we know we are done? I said, well, we're here to find out if our marriage can survive or not, and we'll know we're done when we have that answer. And regardless, our relationship is forever. So what do we need to do and think about to protect that? And then we came to the table, how are we going to tell our kids? Not just what we're going to say, but when and in what location and what day of the week and what time of the day. And let me be clear, Tegan, a good divorce does not mean an easy divorce. Mm. It's painful. It's grief. It's sticky. But I think spouse and I were able to have an onstage life and an offstage life. An onstage for the kids was just not putting them in the middle, not sharing all the adult garbage for them to have to carry around psychically. And offstage, that's where we kept our difficult conversations, which is kind of what we do when we're married, right? If we're doing it well, we have those hard conversations behind closed doors. We don't involve our children in all the financials of the household. So we were able to, you know, in short, love our children more than we ever disliked each other.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that word you said before, like it can be good, it doesn't have to be easy. It feels like it's going to be hard no matter which way you do it. You might as well choose hard and good rather than hard and bad.
Absolutely. And really, I think the thing that we did that most protected our future, and let me say this, how we begin is often how we end. And if your first phone call is to a shark attorney and they're going to go after that opposing counsel who's representing your spouse, someone you once had a love story with, and we immediately pick up divorce as a weapon to use against each other, you're going to have trouble. It's really hard to come back from that. But instead, if you work with a coach, a consultant, a therapist, and you begin to think we can design our divorce rather than doing divorce by default, that those early stages, and maybe even go upstream a little bit further, which is many of us just stay too long. And that's a problem. Mm. Because now the house is already on fire, burning to the ground before we even get out the door, versus many of us know things are going south and we stay. And I do believe fight for your marriage. But when it becomes clear, find the elegant exit, not I'm going to keep driving by that exit for another 2 to 3 years and we're going to run this sucker into the ground so we can justify the exit. That's not a great place to start.
Yeah. Divorce, not as a weapon, but maybe as a tool. You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Karen McNenny, author of The Good Divorce, How to End Your Marriage Without Ending Your Family, dropping pearls of wisdom about how to rethink how you even begin with a divorce, how you can reshape your family without maybe breaking it apart. If you reckon you've managed to nail this, I'd love to know how you did it. Liz says, I'm all for abandoning that thoughtless term, broken family. Even a bad divorce can fix a lot of problems, not least the stress for kids of living in a house full of tension and conflict. Well, Karen, I'm really interested to pick up something. One of the sort of foundations of your premise is the idea that a divorce isn't a deconstruction, it's a renovation. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not unlike what your listener just texted to us, that if we look at divorce as something that's supposed to improve the situation, not make it worse, why would we spend tens of thousands of dollars and months or years of our life just to come out with a worse divorce than the bad marriage, just saying you're bad marriage? So if we are able to think about, okay, I'm going to be in touch with my spouse as a business partner. We're in the business of raising our kids together. And I'm renovating the family across two homes. I'm not burning it down and now we're that, you know, that broken family, but really thinking of a renovation of, we're no longer intimate partners. We're no longer financial partners in the same home. We're no longer roommates. How many people are just bad roommates that cause a lot of high conflict? And if you have a kitchen that doesn't have good feng shui and the plumbing's bad and this is in the wrong place, we're like, let's renovate it to make it better. And if you've lived through renovation, it kind of sucks. It takes longer than you want. It usually costs more than you expect. But on the other side of it, like, hey, this actually is an improvement. And what we know through research is that it is better for children to live across two happy homes with fulfilled, happy parents than to live in one intact home that has high conflict.
You're telling me your stories as well on the text line, Karen. Some people, I think, have a very similar mindset to you. Kate said, the separation firstly is the one. If handled okay, it will help with the divorce. My husband would have the kids every second weekend and sometimes other times when needed. He came to dinner every Wednesday night and put them to bed. He lived about 10Ks away, so easy access when needed. Our children came first. It wasn't their fault. Another says three simple things. One, keep the lawyers out of it. Two, be an adult. Don't dissolve into a vengeful, spiteful teenager. Three, keep looking towards the rest of your life. Don't make divorce your central identity. Karen, what do you make of those tips?
Oh my gosh, Australia, you are so enlightened. You are like an ambassador, movers and shakers of this movement. And we need family-centered divorce reform. And when I sit down with a couple and begin their journey, I always say, let's think about your children's wedding day. Let's go all the way to the future and the graduation and the grandbabies. Mm. You're going to be there for all of it. Do you want your children to have to navigate your high drama on their wedding day? No. Do you want to be able to sit with your grandkids on their fifth birthday so you can all be there celebrating? Yes. Well, that work starts at the very first steps. And that's mindset. We're using divorce not to weaponize against each other, but as a tool to transform our family. As you said, that renovation to become a two-home family, still a family, but we live across two homes. And I want to be clear as well that when there is coercion, if there is abuse, active addiction, mental health issues that are not being addressed, those are not ideal candidates for a good divorce. Those have much larger issues and probably need different kind of support. But honestly, there's a lot of us just regular folk who need to get unmarried and want to do so in a more simple and less destructive process.
I want to come back to getting unmarried, but let's talk for a second about when things are bad. There's been a betrayal. There's a really unhealthy dynamic. It may be a dangerous dynamic. What are the options there, Karen?
If you find that you are not safe physically or emotionally, that doesn't mean, you know, many of us are unhappy, but physically, emotionally unsafe, that typically is a time where an attorney who knows the law and can protect you. There might be protective orders that are needed. Certainly your own mental health specialist who's going to support you to navigate those things. Every case is really unique. And there are times when there are bad players, and that's when attorneys serve us best. But when that other opposing counsel is representing, right, someone that you're going to have to see at the ballet concert next week, let's not add more pain and destruction to that core relationship. And then the kids obviously are the ones who get the trickle-down effect of parents who can't sit in the same room together. That sucks for children.
It's such an interesting thing seeing all these stories coming through as well. Karen, on the text line, this person says, we had a good divorce back in the 80s. We shared two kids and decided to do it ourselves and focused on protecting our ability to raise the kids. No lawyers. We did it ourselves and the court helped us when we did things wrong. No acrimony, no fighting over stuff, and it worked. Long term, we ended up being better friends than partners and we still see each other regularly with the kids. So that sounds like a dream scenario. What are your sort of starting point tips for if that's the end point that people are trying to get to?
Yeah, what a beautiful story, and congratulations to the people who have the courage to navigate it on their own. When we think about how we begin is often how we end, the beginning is not finances. The beginning is family. And I really advocate stabilize family before you start dividing finances. And in the attorney's world, they're there to divide the assets. But you have this whole other story. So I like to begin with a communication strategy with a family. Okay, we have to tell the kids. That usually is the obvious one. And again, I don't want you just to think about what you're going to say, but the day of the week, the time of the day. Is there a football game afterwards you're all going to? Is it grandma's 80th birthday that weekend? Like, be thoughtful. But then there's also the circle of support around the kids, teachers, coaches. Inform them what's happening, and then your own circle of support, grandmas, grandpas, aunties, the shared friends, sending out what we would consider a wedding announcement. Well, let's have a divorce announcement. I call it the public service announcement that says, hey, we just wanted you all to know that there's a significant change happening in our family. This does not come easily. We're all heartbroken by it, but we know it is the right decision. You don't need to pick sides. We're not going to be dramatic. Be on the side of the kids. Don't ask us why. Ask us how we're doing. Like, you actually are guiding your circle of support of how we want you to behave and not hijack our divorce. And there's a lot of shadow figures that can show up. So this is a tool that I think a lot of people don't take into consideration. And once they start to implement it, it just sets the tone. And now we don't have all the gossip and the fight and other people who are stuck in the old narrative. You better lawyer up. You got to take them in the shorts. You better, they're going to screw you over. Oh, no, that's actually not what we're doing. And we don't want you to fan a fire like that. It's not good for our children. And then we also get to tell our kids, hey, you don't have to be the communicator or the ambassador of this news. We have told your teachers, we have told your coaches, the homes you go to for a play date, we've told those people. So it's a really specific micro action that galvanizes the couple together on a unified front of saying, this is what we're doing, this is how we're doing it, and this is how you can support us in this process. That's the starting gate.
Well, Karen, when you put it like that, it sounds so simple. Thank you so much for sharing your advice. Karen McNenny, divorce consultant, author of The Good Divorce, How to End Your Marriage Without Ending Your Family. It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, a children's storyteller who wants you to write the stories of your grandparents down.
What's loaded with fun for the whole family? ABC iView.
Bring it!
Stories that keep you guessing, like The Investigators and Caper Crew.
And I'm in it to win it.
Or adventures that go big, like Ninjago Dragons Rising and Mr. Bean Animated. Attack! And laughs aplenty with Andy Lee's Do Not Watch This Show. Stories, adventures and laughs to stream together.
You can keep watching.
Find it all on ABC iView.
All throughout July on Life Matters, I'm bringing you the Grandparent Trap series. We've been unpacking the realities of modern grandparenting, and I've been introducing you to a few prominent Australians in a way that you maybe don't recognise. You've met Mondo, Ray Martin, when he becomes a granddad with superpowers, Nana or Gaga Lynn, which is a home and away's Lynn McGranger, and you're about to meet children's book author Jacqueline Harvey, who became a step-nana 2 years ago, bringing a totally new kind of love into her life.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline Harvey. I'm a children's author and I'm also Nanny Jack to my little two-year-old grandson, Albie. Albie is my stepdaughter's son, so he's technically my step-grandson. He is our only grandchild and much-loved, very precious little boy who lights up the room, I guess. I've been Liv's stepmom since she was 10 years old and she's now in her 30s, so I have been in her life for a really long time. And my husband and I, we were absolutely thrilled and delighted to find out that Liv and Ben, her partner, were having a baby. But I have to say, and I guess this is a really, honest response from me, I remember the night that they told us that they were having the baby, we had been out for a lovely dinner, and I'm thrilled. But I think I got into the car and probably burst into tears because I'm not a mum, as in a biological mum, and I had tried for many years to become pregnant. And so while I was, absolutely thrilled about the baby, I think it also hammered home that part of me that had missed out as well. So, I allowed myself a very fleeting moment of sadness and then just got on with it. And I have to say, when he arrived, my husband and I were at the hospital very soon after he was born, and taking one look at him, that just enormous flood of love that you have for the little people in your life was there straight away. I don't see him very often. My husband lives most of the time in Queenstown in New Zealand, and I live half of the time there and come back to Australia to work. When I'm back in Sydney, I'm, make sure that I go and see Albie and spend time with him, and I'm going to spend Sunday with him this week. So I'm, very excited about that. You can still have a relationship with your grandchildren more easily these days because of technology, and because, you get on FaceTime, we get on FaceTime with Albie, and he'll tell us stuff, or his mum will just set up the camera so that we just watch him play, and occasionally he'll look at us and tell us something. And I think, even though there is the tyranny of distance at times, and, we're not just down the road and able to do the school drop-off, you can still be an important part of your grandchild's life. As a children's author, I love that I can read him stories that I've actually written. And he took me into his bedroom, which was gorgeous. He led me down the hallway and took me into his room. And I wrote a story called Kevin the Sheep, and it's his favourite. He loves to read that every night. And he pointed at the book and I said, "Who's that?" And he said, "Kevin." And I said, "Who wrote that?" And he looked at me and he said, "My nanny Jack." And I think I was quite teary at that point. So, I love to do stuff that's just hanging out. I was a really fortunate kid. When I was born, I had 4 out of 4 grandparents, and I had 6 out of 8 great-grandparents, which is highly unusual, I know, in many ways. And my last great-grandparent died when I was 14, and my last grandmother died it's coming up 3 years ago. And so I was in my 50s when my grandma died. And so I had the absolute pleasure of knowing them for so many years, for all of my life. I will say, though, I think being able to spend so much time with my grandparents when I was a kid and then into adulthood, I really relished the opportunity to ask them to tell me their stories and to know about their lives. And I think it's something I say to kids all the time when I'm in schools, if you are fortunate enough to have an older person in your life, be they a grandparent, be they an elderly neighbour, an aunt, great aunt, great uncle, make sure that you ask them to tell you their stories, because, it's once they go, often those stories go with them. And so, I think that's a really important part of grandparenting and being a grandchild, is to make sure you connect and talk to your grandparents. I suppose that was something that worried me a little bit to begin with. Would I be as much of a nan as the other grandmas? And I honestly feel like, I'm every bit as much his grandmother as his other two grandmas are. So it hasn't been difficult at all. And in many ways, I think it's brought the family together more. We've kind of all come together now, and that's because of Albie. One of the unexpected things that Albie has taught me is that thing of, it doesn't matter whether they're your blood or not, he's my family. And I mean, not that that's unexpected, but I suppose having wanted to be a mum myself, for a long time, and having endured a lot of IVF and all that sort of, and not getting a baby, the fact that I feel this very, absolute pure love for him, I think is really, that's lovely from my perspective.
Nanny Jack, Jacqueline Harvey, her reflections there, including a reminder to capture those precious stories from your own grandparents. And if that resonates, make sure you tune in tomorrow. Beverly Wang will be with you for Life Matters After Nine tomorrow. She's going to be taking your calls on the life lessons you want to pass on as a grandparent, or the ones that you hold dear from your own grandparents. So she'll be speaking with renowned author and proud pa, Tony Birch, and family historian Tanya Evans. That's our final installment of The Grandparent Trap tomorrow on Life Matters with Beverly Wang. You can check out all the episodes. Just search The Grandparent Trap on ABC Listen. Because you're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, what if free will isn't actually real? You got up this morning. Good job. You chose which mug to drink your tea out of. Good job. You made up your mind what shoes you would wear. Good job. You decided to turn on Radio National. Thank you. All these choices and decisions were made out of your own free will, weren't they? A recent study says accepting that free will doesn't exist can reduce hatred and increase forgiveness. The experiment had people write about a time where they hurt someone or where they were hurt by someone, and how they felt in both instances was affected depending on whether or not they believed they had free will. And I'm going to unpack that more in a tick. But I want to hear from you. If free will is an illusion, how does that impact the way you live your life? We're getting philosophical because I'm here with Patrick Stokes, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly for Ask Aristotle. Pat, you're here with me, but have you done so out of your own free will?
Well, I don't know that anyone's done anything out of their own free will, but that doesn't mean that I haven't chosen it. So there's a whole bunch of ways we can get around this. This is absolute like philosophy 101, you know, party trick stuff, right? The free will thing. This is core business for us. So
it's a party trick that makes me feel stupid, and I don't like that. What do you mean?
Well, there's this whole idea that seems to have arisen, I think, sometime probably around the Enlightenment. So we're sort of talking 18th century, 17th century, that as we come to understand the physical world as governed by laws that constrain how matter works, it suddenly comes to seem really weird that we think that we humans are somehow not part of the causal chain, that we can just decide, oh, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. Whereas everything else is all governed by cause and effect. And so, you know, it's easy to sort of step back and say, well, from a scientific world view or from a scientific perspective, free will has to be an illusion, because how could we be somehow exempt from the chain of cause and effect that governs everything else? And so many of our practices like psychology, marketing, politics, all this stuff is built on the idea that human behavior is actually to some extent causally determined. And if you just know the right inputs, you can make people act in a certain way. But yeah, people find this horrifying, and there's a lot of pushback against it in different ways.
You know the meme where the lady looks confused and there's maths around her head? That's the face I'm making right now. What did we think? What did we think was happening before the Enlightenment?
Well, it's interesting. There was this understanding that matter that we saw in the sky seemed to be really regular, because people noticed that the planets, you know, go in very predictable dimensions, and you could even predict when eclipses and things were going to happen. So we worked out that big things in the sky were working according to set physical laws. But it was kind of assumed that's not really how things worked here on Earth, because everything was messy. But then over time, more and more of these physical laws became determined, and suddenly everything starts to look really law-like and regular, even if it's messy and you have to look really hard. And so you end up with the kind of apotheosis of this is a thought experiment in 18th century called Laplace's Demon. Laplace was a physicist and an astrophysicist, and he basically said, look, if you know the position of every particle in the universe and which way it's traveling and at what speed, and if you know all the laws that govern the movements of those particles, then in theory you could predict every single thing that will ever happen from this moment onwards. Right. And if that's the case, then free will has to be an illusion, because things have to go the way they're going to go, and there's no other way they could turn out.
But like, does that mean I don't have to agonize over what I order at the restaurant because it was preordained that I was going to have like the gnocchi or something?
I would love to tell you that you don't have to agonize over it, but here's the thing. These are not things we can actually live with or live in. They're what Raymond Gaider, actually an Australian philosopher, once called blackboard doubts. You know, I can convince you in a nice warm philosophy seminar room that you have no free will, or that you might be dreaming right now, or any of those things. But you can't then live like that, right? So even hard determinists still look both ways when they cross the street, right? Every time I go to the pub with the kids for dinner, they say, Dad, you're just going to have the Palmer. But I'm like, no, I'm going to have a look at the menu and I'm going to, oh, maybe this, maybe that. And then I get the Palmer. So I am actually acting in a way where I probably don't have free will. I'm a predictable mechanism that always goes for the Palmer. But I still experience myself as making a choice. And all of our practices, including things like our moral practices, praise, blame, and so on, holding people accountable. These things all take freedom of action, which we experience as being a core part of our world. So to me, things like freedom, and also I think even things like moral principles, are kind of like colours. You can explain colour away with a purely scientific story that says that viewed from a God's eye view, a purely scientific objective view, the universe doesn't contain colour. It's an illusion created by the specifics of our brains and light waves and so on. But that doesn't mean the sky suddenly stops looking blue once you know that. And in the same way, even if determinism is true, even if we have no free will, we can't stop acting like we have to make choices and that those choices matter.
Okay, because I want to come back to this study. Basically, the study was like when people were told that free will didn't exist, they were more self-compassionate and compassionate of others, which is interesting, like if we can get people to feel more compassionate. But you also used the word moral in there, like do we absolve ourselves from any wrong that we've ever done if we just kind of like, well, don't have free will, yeah. So...
There's actually some other data that suggests that people are much more forgiving of their own errors on the grounds of, well, I couldn't help it. But they tend to hold other people to account for the same errors on the basis of, well, I chose to do that. I think that you don't have to go as far as full determinism, right? It may well be the case that getting people to think about constraint makes them more forgiving, and that's good. But what that means is not you have to go to the point of there is no free will, everything we do is determined. What you can do is say, I should just be a little bit more forgiving of other people, because very often people are under sorts of constraints that I'm not aware of, or I myself might be under forms of constraint that I'm not aware of. So it's a good thing to be thinking about the extent to which people are not necessarily in control of their actions, or the way in which they couldn't necessarily have done thing otherwise. It's a good thing to just be a bit more forgiving in general. That doesn't mean we necessarily have to buy into a full kind of deterministic metaphysics. In a way, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter whether free will is an illusion or not. We're stuck with it, but we also do need to be kind of, you know, cutting each other some slack.
Do you think that they'll ever be like, oh, well, we've solved it once and for all, like free will does exist or free will doesn't exist, or you think that that's impossible?
I almost feel like there was a kind of tacit, almost unspoken consensus in science that, yeah, free will's not real. We had that, and then suddenly quantum physics appears and everyone's like, oh yeah, but on the quantum level. So my sense is that that's probably going to be one of those questions that's just going to seesaw backwards and forwards indefinitely. I don't know if there's ever going to be a complete 100%, you know, answer to that scientifically or even philosophically, but at the same time, you know, predicting what the distant future looks like is a mug's game.
So now you've gone to all the trouble of exploding my brain. What do I do with this information, Pat? How do I take this conversation and this study and implement it in my life?
Well, you go about your business, which is all you can do when you've had thought through these big, deep philosophical things where you think, oh, maybe everything's an illusion, or maybe we're living in a simulation. What actually changes when you leave the seminar room? Some things you might be a little bit more attuned to the constraints that other people are under. You might be a little more likely to ask yourself, could this person have really done otherwise when you're angry with them? That's good. But as I say, I don't think you're going to suddenly, you know, live as if you have no control over your life, because I don't think you can. This is why Immanuel Kant said that free will is what he called a postulate of practical reason. The way we live means it has to be true, at least on that practical level, whatever the sort of deep metaphysical facts might turn out to be.
Yeah, he wasn't called Immanuel Kant, he was called Immanuel Kant. Well, Pat, thanks for joining me as always. Pat Stokes is with me to make you question the laws of the universe fortnightly for Ask Aristotle. For the rest of the time, he's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University. It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Almost almost all I've got time for you. With you today here, I've come to you from Jagera and Turrbal land. I've really enjoyed receiving your texts today. We were talking earlier about the Good Divorce book by my guest who I spoke to, and you were sharing your tips on how you've managed to achieve a good divorce. One says, the old adage, every arrow you aim at your ex will land in the heart of your child, should be kept in mind at all time when parents are parting. Another says, I initiated divorce over 30 years ago, sat down with my lawyer husband to plan separation and divorce. We've had an excellent relationship since. Hard to keep lawyers out of it if you were married to one. Well, tomorrow on Life Matters, Beverly Wang will be with you talking grandparenting life lessons for our Grandparent Trap series. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you again on Monday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.